Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Marius Root. Marius, you've just returned from Namibia. How are you doing?
I'm all right, and you guys? Yeah, first trip to Namibia. Interesting place, obviously a lot of similarities to us, but also quite a few differences. And they're obviously quite interested in our elections because that's going to impact them. And they're also voting later this year, and also the first time there, SWAPO could also lose its majority. So also something to keep an eye on there.
Interesting. And we are also joined today by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Yeah, doing well, thank you. I haven't been anywhere near as exotic as where Marius has jetted off to. We've got, I think, quite an exciting week coming up. So I'm glad I'm in Johannesburg at this time. Whatever happens, it's the place to be.
I don't know if Namibia is that exotic, seeing as it's right next door to us, Chris. But anyway.
I mean, for me, anything outside Johannesburg is, sure, that's risking it.
You said John's right.
So it is. Yeah, it is a very exciting time in South African politics. We have these big elections coming up on Wednesday next week. And I think kind of pretty much whatever the results are, it's going to be a very impactful election in the country's history. If the ANC somehow manages to retain its majority, if they get sort of 51, 52% of the vote, that's going to say something very big about our politics, about how change happens and the strength of the ANC. But if the ANC goes the other way and gets, you know, closer to 40 than 50, it may also say something very big about how the country is changing in ways that many people thought were never going to happen. So, very eventful election. We're very likely to have an election special next week, Friday, analyzing some of the results as they come in. That's, you know, that depends a little bit on how many of the results have come in, and you know whether any of us will be able to get enough sleep. But there'll be more details about that next week. In the meantime, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that will definitely be changing in South Africa after the election. And one of them is that Minister for Trade, Industry and Competition, Ibrahim Patel, has announced that he is going to be retiring after this election and not willing to stand as a minister anymore. He has spent 15 years as a major player in South Africa's economic policy. And he says that this will be the last term in cabinet. There is a time for everything in life. Having served 15 years, I think one may now step back. Now, I think he said this in an interview with Business Day or Business Live. They describe him as having a mixed legacy, which we can get into a little bit now. I think that's a little bit generous to call it mixed. He said, talking about South Africa's economic progress, "We have had to grow the economy, but also deal with asset and income inequality. The economy is significantly more transformed than it was 15 or 30 years ago. We've made enormous progress given the constraints we faced. Undoubtedly, unquestionably, there has been success, though there's a tendency for the narrative to focus on not having done enough. We need to do more." He also argued that when it comes to deindustrialization, that things were not so bad in South Africa, saying that the actual real value of manufacturing output has gone up between 2019 and today, but manufacturing's share of GDP declined. He said that some of this was our very fast deliberalization of the labor market without increasing supply, and that created job losses. Anyway, Chris, I've talked a lot on the show about how I think that Ibrahim Patel is in many ways, I think we even had an episode, the architect of our suffering. maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration, but I do think that Ibrahim Patel has been a very negative force in South African politics, on our economic policy. I think he cares, and I think personally he's always been committed to the well-being of this country. Unfortunately, I think that his ideological proclivities and his ideas about how to run the South African economy have been pretty disastrous. Do you want to talk a little bit about this issue? I believe you have some graphs for us today.
Yeah, I mean, to start off with, since 2012, South Africa has averaged GDP growth per year of 0.8%. So what does that tell you about our macroeconomic policies, about our policy choices? about opening up the economy, about improving people's living standards, etc. I know this might be a bit reductionist, but generally with GDP growth, when line goes up, things are good, especially when it comes to GDP and GDP per capita. So this particular graph from the CRA's flagship briefing this year, On the Edge, we look at South Africa's GDP per capita falling by a quarter against the world average. And Minister Patel has been in government since 2009, so I won't put it all on him since 2008, but at least since 2009, you look at your average South African becoming poorer over time, their money not going as far as it used to, purchasing power of their money. And that's largely a result of policies in manufacturing, construction, of course, electricity production as it pertains to Eskom, all inhibiting economic activity and economic growth. You can talk about wanting to quote-unquote transform the economy. It doesn't really help if that economy continues to shrink and if there isn't, if there aren't more job opportunities going around. And then secondly, just looking at the relationship between social grants and the number of people employed. And again, here, the importance of industries like mining, manufacturing, agriculture, and construction. One of the best performing sectors in the South African economy is financial services, which tends to be medium to higher skilled and higher education. If you look at your sectors like manufacturing and construction, those are very important for getting more people into formal economic activity and employment and raising their general living standards. Here, I just want to highlight this particular orange line where you look at the number of people employed in about 2007, 2008 was around the 15 million mark. If we go all the way to the right-hand side, 2019, 2020, we're back at that 14 million recently, a little bit up to about 16 million. But in all that time, only adding, let's go for argument's sake, adding 2 million people to employment. Is that indicative of successful policies in the areas of trade, industry, and competition? I don't think so. And just the last thought around the localization master plans, that is the big focus of the DTIC and of government more broadly as regards its trade and economic policy footing. Those master plans, it's one thing to say you want to encourage local manufacturing, but if the only way you do that is through providing subsidies for established players, through not addressing the factors like electricity supply, your reliability of your ports and your railways, if you don't fix those things, you can dump all the subsidies that you want into local manufacturing. It's going to tend to benefit more established players, those with the necessary political connections. And it's just going to inhibit the emergence of new competitors and the inhibiting, I think, of competitive, vibrant sectors and markets in your domestic economy. So to say that he leaves a mixed legacy, I think, is way too kind.
Ibrahim Patel, in his time as in the economy sector, has produced an enormous number of policies and documents and master plans and all sorts of things about how we were going to increase manufacturing and this and that, and in the end, it all came to naught. And I think that's probably because there was a little bit too much detail on those plans. Maurice, what's your take on Ibrahim Patel's career? And do you agree that? It's probably for the best that he will no longer be in cabinet.
Well, I actually just read a very interesting book, not about Ibrahim Patel, but by a guy called Charlie Robertson. It's called The Time Traveling Economist. And in it, he says there are three requirements for a country to start industrializing and getting out of poverty. South Africa has all those three things. It's a low fertility rate. So average woman have between 2 and 3 kids through a lifetime. Average electricity supply of, I think, 300 kilowatts per hour per capita. And literacy rate of above about 70%. South Africa has all those things. I mean, our electricity supply per capita is actually much higher than that. And our per capita, our fertility rate is about 2.2 kids per woman now, which is barely above replacement level. But in the book, South Africa is noted as one of the places where something is going wrong. It's not developing as it should. He's an economist. So he's got a model of if you fit these certain requirements, your economy should be growing. South Africa's economy, according to how it's structured and all those things that I just mentioned, should be growing, according to this model, at about 4% a year. As we all know, it's growing at about not even 1% a year. So there's obviously something going very wrong. And one of the things he mentions, like when Chris pointed out, the average income per capita for South Africans compared to the world, 20 or 30 years ago or so, the average South African had an average income per capita of about 30% or a third of the United States. Now it's about 20%. So we're really getting being left behind. And I think one of the major reasons for that is Ibrahim Patel. I think one thing you can maybe say about him, I don't think he's necessarily a malicious person. There have never been any real accusations of corruption. But just because you're not malicious doesn't mean you don't do bad things. And I think his ideology, he's obviously a communist or very left-wing. And this has seen what his policies have done to the South African economy. And I always like to say on the show, it's, behind all those numbers, the 33% of people are unemployed. There's a human being behind each of those numbers and somebody who's despondent and can't provide for themselves or their family and has got no hope for the future. And every night is going home hungry. And that's something it's destroying lives. And that's one of the biggest tragedies of post-apartheid South Africa, I think, is the number of people who don't have work and whose lives are really not going anywhere and often not through any fault of their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely right. You know, there are a few ministers in, Ibrahim Patel's time in government is, I think, the cautionary tale of the unintended consequences. Like you said, you know, he probably shares with Pravin Gordhan. In fact, he's probably got a better reputation than Pravin Gordhan for sort of being above the muck of politics and, you know, being involved with corruption and that kind of thing. But he has probably unintentionally resulted in more human misery in this country than almost any other minister, which I think says something about how important economic policy actually is. If you don't get this stuff right, you're going to cause a lot of suffering to a lot of people. Chris, any final thoughts?
Just on what South Africa has in its favor, and if you continue to shoot yourself in the foot with the wrong policy choices, then you're always going to hold back people's potential, their ability to increase their living standards, et cetera, looking at just our mineral deposits, for example, over the years, how we continue even in 2024 to focus so much on the export of raw materials instead of having that ability to beneficiate locally, to add value locally. So we export and then we import complex and finished goods, thereby also increasing, of course, imported inflation. So it's ironic that we want to up our manufacturing base locally, but we end up, and because we don't support those, I think, in a substantive way with the right macroeconomic policies, we just set ourselves up for, I think, more costly goods over time, which, to tie in with Morris' comment, that impacts the most on your poorer to middle income citizens who have to spend more of their disposable income on things that should have been cheaper than they otherwise could have been.
And if you listen to ANC policymakers, MPs, bureaucrats, that kind of thing, all they talk about is local value add and beneficiation and, you know, moving away from mineral exports and that kind of thing. It has been the total obsession of government. It has been Ibrahim Patel's focus. And yet, because the policies are bad, we have achieved exactly the opposite effect. Like I said, unintended consequences. Okay. So let us move on to our next story. And this is an opinion column from Natasha Marion, which argues that Jacob Zuma and his MK party won't last, that they are very much a one election kind of factor. And we'll have to see what happens afterwards. But she says, Jacob Zuma will inflict damage on the ANC, which it deserves after shielding him and elevating him over the country for more than a decade. But that is where it will end. SA is not the ANC. There's no going back for Zuma now. A bunch of things here. She talks about how Zuma, after failing to secure control of the ANC back in 2017 through his candidate, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, then was kind of on the outside of ANC politics. There was an attempted sort of move to try and get him and his faction back in power through Ace Makashule, who was the Secretary General of the ANC, which didn't work either, as Ace Makashule was then expelled from the ANC after a period of sort of behind-the-scenes infighting. And she basically argues that his attempt to start the MK party is not really so much driven by, you know, his coming back and his restoration of his political force, but rather out of pure desperation, that this is essentially an attempt to get access again to power and resources so that he can stave off the financial and possibly legal consequences of so much that has happened in his career. It does. She does say that, and I'm going to quote here. No, Morris was thinking of quoting this as well. There is one glaring difficulty for Zuma, however. The organizational muscle of the ANC has always masked his incompetence, proclivity for destruction, and general decisiveness of his presence. The more than a century-old liberation movement was battered, bruised, and crushed in the process, but the organization cushioned him. Now Zuma is a one-man show, with no Gweda Mantashe at his side to battle for the hyenas when they come for him, no Nomvula Mokonyane to lift the rand with various body parts, or Ramaphosa to hand him a get-out-of-jail-free card. He is on his own. Maurice, do you agree with this assessment? There is a counter-argument that suggests that while Zuma... there's definitely, you know, a lot of MK is based off of Zuma's personal brand. It's not just that, and it also might be tapping into that market which has largely been untapped into in South Africa, which is a kind of traditionalist conservative market that, you know, kind of belongs to the IFP, kind of belongs to the ANC, and that, you know, while without Zuma, it won't have as much impact, maybe there's still space for it. I don't know. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that market does exist, but I think it's hard to get to. And I think without Zuma, the MK party wouldn't have stood a chance. Even outside KwaZulu-Natal, the MK party is doing absolutely nothing. If you look at polling, it's nowhere really outside Natal. In the few by-elections, it stood outside of KZN, where there are few Zulu people. It's got like 1% of the vote. The DA is actually more popular in couple of places that where the MK stood than MK was, and these are, you know, township boards and stuff where the DA traditionally doesn't do well, but were still more popular than MK in places where there aren't really many Zulu people. And it does seem not there's not been one serious person that's joined Jacob Zuma in MK. I think the only fairly senior person from the ANC that went there was Des van Rooyen. And we all know he's not a very serious person, the famous weekend special finance minister. So, and he's not exactly a, yeah. They obviously got some money and organization behind them. I mean, they managed to get a whole bunch of people to Orlando Stadium last weekend or whatever it was. A friend of mine, he's from KwaZulu-Natal. And he's from Atatiel, actually, but he was in KwaZulu-Natal recently. And he said there were a lot of MK t-shirts and posters around in rural KwaZulu-Natal. But that obviously doesn't always translate to votes. But I mean, Jan Gateng, I think I've seen maybe three MK posters. And I saw a couple in Mpumalanga when I was there about a month ago. So there's obviously some money and organizational muscle behind them, but not, I don't think, a significant amount. And I do think this has just been, this is a personal vehicle for Jacob Zuma. I think he probably believes some of the stuff that's coming out of it. But I think in the main, this is a vehicle for him to protect himself from prosecution. And this kind of Stalingrad strategy, I mean, he's, the court date's been set now, so he's really running out of time. So I think this is also a Hail Mary for him, I think. Hopefully, he's hoping the MK can do pretty well, and he can do some kind of deal with the ANC after the election, saying, cool, we'll support you, but you got to, Ramaphosa must pardon Zuma or whatever, something like that.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to watch. I will, you know, on one hand, you can kind of see, at least initially, there was evidence that MK had some kind of organizational ability. But then you sort of see these other kind of cracks in the organization. For example, all of the MK posters use a badly cropped version of Zuma's official presidential portrait for his posters. They didn't take a new photo, which is kind of, you know, it's a very small detail, but it's one of those things that suggests that this was all in a little bit of a hurry, and maybe they didn't have time or money to properly kind of go through this methodically. Chris, what do you make of the longevity of MK? Do you think that, you know, let's assume that MK has an amazing election. Let's say they get 15% of the vote, which, to be fair, no poll has put them at, but let's say they get that, right? Will that be enough to keep them alive? Or do you think that, like Morris says, they're just tied to how Jacob Zuma is doing?
That sort of share would definitely be enough to keep them alive if you have some sort of organizational management capacity that can take that forward. So it's one thing to start a political party, but then to actually build on momentum, to keep it going in a sustainable way, all those sorts of things I don't really yet see from the organization. I know the current or the former or the, I don't know, Schrodinger's founder of MK, Jabulani Khumalo, he was this week at the IEC's sort of elections station saying, no, he's there representing MK. So what's going on? So between him, Zuma, who exactly is in charge. That's a question whether Zuma can manage. I mean, not to underestimate him by any means. I think people who have done that over the years have really shot themselves in the foot. But whether he still has that capacity to counter any of the moves against him is a different question as well. Is he happy for one of his children maybe to take the lead in MK if he decides, okay, I've secured a vote now, I can get concessions from the ANC, I'm fine now, like I'm immune from prosecution. And then just the last point around longevity, I wonder whether internally they realized maybe they wouldn't be able to carry as much momentum into the elections, and that's why they only launched very late in last year. If they launched earlier in 2023, maybe you would have seen that rapid increase and then a much faster decline before this year's elections. Maybe they already didn't time it particularly well. But I also think that's something to look into. What was the reason behind only doing it then? You know, access to funds, all that sort of stuff, that would be a consideration. But also your general momentum and what the ANC can do to you. Because despite the issues for the ANC, funding-wise, organizationally-wise, when you have a certain individual in charge of your as your Secretary General, I also worry about your organizational capacity. But it's still the ANC. That machinery, I think, is quite formidable. And MK maybe realized they needed to strike at an optimal time.
Yes. No. It's also worth noting that maybe the late launch also helped save the party from some of the infighting. Because if the party had been around for a year longer, maybe the infighting would be even worse than what it's already been. You know, it's going to be very funny on election night if both Zuma and Jabulani Khumalo are in the IEC election center claiming to be the true king of MK. But anyway, that's just a fun little detail that we're going to get to watch. Maurice, any final thoughts before we move on?
I think just one final thing. We've got to remember also Jacob Zuma is 82 years old, and there were some reports recently that he'd his health wasn't great. Apparently, he'd collapsed at home or something. And that was only about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And also, 82, however you slice it, that's old. And I don't think he's got the energy he did 20 years ago. I think Chris is very right. You underestimate Jacob Zuma at your peril. Thabo Mbeki learned that, I think. But there's also only so much maneuvering you can do. And I do think he's strategically a very clever guy in that. But, you know, your luck also runs out. And as I say, he's an old guy. I don't think he's got the kind of energy that, you know, he would have had even 15 years ago. So I do think, we'll have to see what happens now. But I don't think he's really, he's not what he used to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the guy lived a hard life. He grew up in a very rural area. He spent time, obviously, in prison on Robben Island. You know, a few years ago, one of his wives allegedly tried to poison him, and some of the reporting suggests that his health has never really been the same since then. He's clearly well enough to go out and, you know, campaign quite aggressively. So he's not on death's door as was claimed on his medical parole. But yeah, I agree. He's an old guy who's lived a hard life. And that does suggest that if the entire party is based off of his personality, that is really not long for this world then. Anyway. On that morbid note, let's go on to the next story. And this is something that might play a role in the election, but I think it's a little bit difficult to tell right now. And that is the Zulu King, King Sizulu, has declared that he is possibly considering taking government to the International Court of Justice because he says that it is trying to steal the Zulu's land from him. Through the Ingonyama Trust. So the Ingonyama Trust is essentially the way that government kind of solved the problem of all of this land that used to belong to the KwaZulu homeland and has also, you know, traditionally been held by Zulu nobility and monarchy over the centuries. And so the Zulu King is the sole trustee of the Ingonyama Trust, but on the board are ministers in government. King has said that he didn't really give a lot of details, but he says that the board of the Ingonyama Trust is trying to sideline him, even though he's the only trustee. He said, quote, "I'm here to report to you as your king and as the chair of the Ingonyama Trust board that we are in a delicate period. We are not getting along on that board. They are refusing to accept me. They want me out, but I don't know how because I'm the sole trustee. But now when I'm chairing it, there seems to be a problem. I'm not here to scare you, but things are not going well. They want to deal with us. They hate us for our land." And anyway, then one of his spokespersons clarified that the king, rather than taking the government to the International Court of Justice, might instead seek what they called international mediation. Marius, this is a bit of a sticky one because on one hand, this is a clearly sort of undemocratic way of, you know, in most constitutional monarchies these days, whether that be Spain, Denmark, the UK, king is really just a figurehead. They don't actually have that much power. And yet in South Africa, we still have an unelected monarch who, you know, is essentially one of the most powerful landholders in the country. Despite the fact that this land sort of kind of technically belongs to government, although in practice it's a little bit more complicated. What do you make of this issue?
I think it's one of these hangovers from the transition where compromises had to be made. Open to correction, yeah, but I believe that it's actually legal for trust to have only one trustee. And obviously the Zulu king is the trustee. So that's something that needs to be dealt with. And there's also, I mean, the question of this kind of dead land, because there have been people living there for years, generations, but they can't really do much with it. They probably don't really want, they can't use it as collateral. They obviously don't want to develop it because it can probably be kicked off at any time. But as you were saying before the show, it's all a bit complicated because it's not clear, you know, we'd have to decide who owns which land if we had to actually give it to the actual people living there. So it's all quite complex, but I just hope that this threat to go to the ICJ doesn't become a new thing in South African politics. I'll get incredibly bored if every time something happens, somebody's going to be threatening to go to the ICJ. You know, if the Lions lose a close rugby game to the Stormers or something, and then the coach says, no, we get the ICJ about this. You know, so let's just hope that this isn't a precedent that's being set. I think it'll all get quite boring if we run at the ICJ about everything.
I think we should support it in that case. When it impacts the Lions negatively, then... You know.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, it's true. I mean, you know, Lions must be defended at all costs.
Yeah, Chris, let's not get into this because I think we'll cause a massive rift amongst our viewers. But it's clear to me that the Ingonyama Trust needs some kind of reform. That reform may be difficult, but you can't have a situation where you have this unclear property rights, where you have unelected people essentially controlling it. And, you know, this is in a country where the government talks constantly about the need for land and the hunger for land and that kind of thing. Well, you know, here's a way to empower lots of the most poor rural people in the country by, you know, giving them actual title deeds and access to land. Things are, as you said, Morris, things may be a bit more complicated. Dividing up that land is maybe complex. A lot of this land is not, I think, clearly delineated as to who owns what. There is an interesting aspect to this, though, which is the kind of enduring power of traditional leaders in South Africa, particularly in a place like KZN, and I think also in the Eastern Cape to some degree, where they were seen as the stooges of the apartheid government by the ANC in the sort of late 80s, and then managed to kind of do this deft political dance where the traditional leaders in the country sort of switched from being the great threat to the ANC, which was in many ways a mostly sort of urban and township-based organization, to being some of its biggest supporters. And now the ANC is actually probably going to rely on areas where traditional leaders have sway to pull in the majority of their votes this election. Chris, what do you make of all this?
Just one maybe long-term trend to keep an eye on. So not to, I don't know, compare the two directly, but obviously a lot of analysis, airtime and focus on Western Cape independence, but not to discount if your central authority or your central state becomes weaker, but also if it seeks out direct confrontation with, I guess, your cultural groups, your linguistic groups, in a country as diverse as South Africa, what might happen around KwaZulu-Natal, around something like, you know, it's an easy phrase, but Zulu exit. I'm not saying it's going to result in that in like 10 years, 20 years, but just those tensions I see increasing. I mean, earlier this year, you had where the ANC provincial spokesperson, Siboniso Duma, had to apologize to King Misi Zulu for grabbing the microphone from traditional Zulu Prime Minister Buthelezi. I thought that was also quite interesting, and that this trend, I think, is picking up in the last while. So you'll likely see this continuing. What does that mean for the ANC during the tenure of former President Zuma? His ability to garner votes for the ANC in KZN was vital to them increasing their their national vote share, given that in this year's elections, you might have four parties all around 20-25% in KZN. That again just increases not just the messiness of a particular provincial coalition, but also which parties, if any, can not assuage, but deal adequately with these sorts of concerns and get that sort of engagement and those partnerships, working partnerships going. So policy considerations aside, I agree with, you know, things around title deeds and strengthening of property rights. Just the dynamics in terms of sort of groups in South Africa, I think, is going to be interesting over the next 10 to 20 years, especially.
Morris, any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just think Chris's point on Zexit, whatever you want to call, is quite a good one. R.W. Johnson recently did some polling down in KZN, and he was saying there's a real sort of feeling of, you know, revolt in there almost. He says it feels like a lot of people are really, they've had enough of Pretoria. And just remember, Natal was always the most reluctant member of the union going back to 1910. And there were always rumblings about secession in the 1980s and 1990s. So if anybody who is keen on Western Cape independence, they should be supporting KwaZulu-Natal secession. I think it was our former boss, Frans Grenier, who said the road to Western Cape independence runs through Lundi. So that's something to look out for. So, yeah, and it's I think we're in for an interesting couple of years. And let's also not forget there is a KwaZulu-Natal independence party, which has a seat on the Etowah City Council. So.
I wonder if they'll get a seat in the legislature. I suspect they won't, because you know, MK, that province is so heavily contested by these big parties. I thought there was going to be a lot of small parties that cut up the vote in KZN in this election, but that doesn't seem to be happening. In part, I think, because you know, we've got MK and the IFP and the DA and the ANC all fighting a very, very vicious campaign to be the top dog in that province, which, according to the SRF tracking poll, is a fight that seems to be being won at the moment by MK in KZN, at least. We'll have to see on election day, though. Still, a lot could change. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope that you found this show interesting. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We will, of course, be back next week. There will be no show on Wednesday because of the election. But then I think, like I said, Friday, we're probably going to have an election special, just talking about what happened, what we got wrong, what we got right, and what the early results suggest might be the direction of the country over the next 5 years. Anyway, have a great one. See you soon.